Okay, Chayisara is a continuation in some ways of Parshas Vayera, that we start off in a way that parallels the first Aliyah of last week's Parsha, because we start off with a theme of Chesed, and we start off with the Kvura that Avraham Avinu undertakes for his wife, for Sarah. And it's quite fascinating that here this is also technically a Chesed. And we find, in fact, that Chazal, there's a Medrash that tells us that HaKadosh Baruch Hu was tremendously impressed with this chesed, and said that when he saw that Avram is burying his wife, that now, tafasta sumunosa, now I see that you really get my profession here, you really get my craft, you really understand what it means to be a Baal Chesed. And that's an interesting thing to say, because here we know, we established at great length in last week's parasha that Avram was a Baal Chesed. So the idea that he's going to bury his own spouse, his own wife, that everybody would do. That's not something you need to be a special Chesed superstar in order to undertake. So why is that all of a sudden highlighted as Avram's true example of acts of kindness? So there are a few approaches that are suggested. The Rashi of Karim B'Avn, Zichron Livracha, of Golvich, he thought that this was perhaps a reflection of the idea that this is what we call, we know in Parashas Vayechi, the term's going to come up, chesed, ve'emes, chesed, shel emes, that it's a focus on the fact that kvura is something that there is no expectation of any reciprocity, that when you take care of somebody who has passed on, so you can't expect them to do anything back for you. And in that sense, it's more of a true chesed. There's no even possibility, at least in this world, of any social capital. It's interesting, if you want to focus on the idea of HaKadosh Baruch Hu modeling chesed, and that we imitate him, something we discussed last week, that we perform acts of chesed because of the halachta bedrachav, that we should follow in his path. So it's possible to suggest also that it doesn't just mean that God does chesed, so we should also do chesed. But we should try as much as possible to do chesed in a HaKadosh Baruch Hu dika way, which is obviously much harder, even harder than it sounds. But nonetheless, perhaps that's how we're supposed to aspire to behave. So when it comes to chesedim overall, the Ribbono Shalom not only performs them, but he has a unique perspective. So for example, when we talk about Nicham Avelim, which is also a theme in the Parsha, so we find that there's an idea within Nicham Avelim, Rav Soloveitchik emphasized, that we should try to convey a sense of perspective that should bring about Nechama. Now, of course, our perspective is very limited, but the Ribbono Shalom has infinite perspective, and the Sfas Emes explains that that's why when we say Ritzei and benching, we refer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu as Baal HaNechamos, meaning that he is the unique master of Nechama, because we strive to try to give Nechama, but we're limited in how much we can really convey a sense of perspective. But the Ribbono Shel Olam, he has the infinite perspective, so he is the one who can give Nechama in a unique fashion, but we strive to imitate him as much as possible. So too, the idea of a chesed doesn't have any kind of a payback, doesn't have any possibility of the other individual reciprocating. So that's one idea, perhaps, on why this is a chesed that brought things to a new level. But there's another issue as well. The author of Slobodka emphasized that very often there are people who are very good at doing things that are very flashy and involve traveling far away and attract a lot of attention. And in that type of chesed, they excel. But the real chesed that is shown to the family members, which al pi halacha, is a priority. Al pi halacha, we say that the obligation of chesed is first directed at those closest to you, including family members. Very often, people are not so good at that, even if they are more adept at the far-off types of chesed. But the real chesed is to do it in its proper seder, so it should start with those closest to you, with the family members. The Altar of Slobodka added that there's also an element that's purer, because when somebody has to come and ask a stranger for help, so then there's also a degree of bizayin that comes along with it. Even though they get the help, but they also have to have some degree of embarrassment. But when somebody is a natural recipient of your chesed because they're a part of your household, so then it's a true chesed, and it doesn't come with the embarrassment. So the idea that Avraham was not only able to extend his kindness to travelers along the road who were actually angels, but to those closest to him, that's a particular appreciation for chesed that is particularly impressive in this sense. So the parasha actually begins with the words "Vayu Chai Yisara Me'ashana Ve'Esrim Shana V'Shav Shanim Shnei Chai Yisara," and we all know the Rashi that tells us that it's written this way in order to suggest a drasha that all the phases are compared to each other. That it's 127, and the way Rashi has it is that it is Baskuf kebaschof lechait, baschof lechata shere ena bas onshin, af baskuf kelechata, baschof kebas zayin liyofi. So it's a question if that really makes sense. Say 20, like 7, that's supposed to represent beauty. You would assume it should be switched around. There are some girsas that do switch these around, and some suggest that it's really a reference to spiritual beauty. To say that just like a person at 7 has a certain innocence. So that's what we're referring to when we say like 20 was like 7. There are other ideas here as well. Some Rishiva had a sikha about this also, that the idea is to note that here we have all these different phases of life, and every phase of life has a mila to it. So when you're older, you're wiser. When you're younger, you're more innocent. When you're youthful, you have more energy and more passion. So she was able to bring all the milas into one package, able to do all of it at once. And there is perhaps also a indication here, Chazal, and one of the Midrashim, quote the Pasuk in Tehillim, in reference to Sarah, Yodea Hashem Yimei Tamimim. She's referred to as one of the Tamimim, one of the perfect ones. So when we talk about perfect, so nobody's perfect, but the Torah tells us to be perfect. Tamim Tiyam Hashem Elokecha. There's a lot to try to figure out about what Tamim means, what it means to be perfect. And maybe we could suggest from some of the contexts, especially Tamim Tiyaz in the context of avoiding Kishuf and Nechush, like we discussed yesterday, that Tamim means that you are protected from the effects of outside circumstances such as time. So here we're being told that Sarah was able to bring all the milas of all the different age brackets. She didn't have any kind of a restraint because of being in one age or the other, that she wasn't affected by time. And in a sense, that works with some of the other usages also. So we talk about Tamim Tia, so a person who is Menachesh, a person who's superstitious, he believes that, okay, this time is going to overtake him. What's time going to do to me tomorrow when I wake up? What's Monday going to do to me? And the Torah is telling us not what Monday is going to do, it's what you're going to do with Monday. It's how you are going to overtake the concept of time. And this is not the time for it. It's not a timely point. But if you think about it, I think that may also work with the idea of Sfiras HaOmer and Tmimos. That the idea is about imposing a structure upon the calendar rather than letting the calendar tell you what to do. So here, Sarah transcended time. So the Medrash refers to her as those among the Tamimim, those who had that midah of perfection, so to speak, are able to rise above time. So there's also a Medrash here. That Medrash tells us that Rabbi Kiva was giving shir, and his Talmidim, believe it or not, started to doze, started to fall asleep. It's not really conceivable in our era, but apparently once upon a time that happened. So he gave them a little bit of a Dvar Torah. He said, look, that here the Torah tells us that Sarah lived to be 127 years. Where else do we find 127 in Tanakh? By Esther, Sarah's descendant, who ruled over 127 nations. 127 nations are connected to 127 years of Sarah. So how does that wake people up? It's such a gavaldic Dvar Torah. You probably could figure out the connection on your own. That's going to really make the guys perk up all of a sudden. So there are some who suggest that the idea is that if it's really the rate, that 127 years gets your descendant 127 countries, so that's one country per year, it's pretty good. So it comes out that it's apparently 1 month can get you a state, and 1 week can get you a big city, and 1 day can get you a town, and an hour can get you a city block. So you see how much your time is worth. So how could you be neglecting Shir? How could you not come to Seder? How could you lose the time? How could you not appreciate how much these minutes are worth? Everything has got so much potential. Look how much the lives of how much the years, and that's also how they understand this idea of Chaye, the lives of Sarah, she put it all together. Look how much she was able to accomplish in her lifetime. There are others who have a different spin on this. Maybe this is a reference to the time of the Gullus, that's what it means. Rabbi Akiva's students were starting to feel the Gullus, they were starting to transition into slumber, so to speak. And he was telling them, don't be Miyash, don't give up. Look at Sarah, how she was able to continue to persevere and give her descendant strength to even rule in Gullus and to triumph over the state of exile. And others, I think, suggest as well that the idea is that they were tired in the sense that they thought they'd done all they could, that they don't have energy to move on. And you look at Sarah, and Sarah, she kept getting everything she could out of life. She kept getting the maximum out of the time that she had. So you guys should also recognize that it's never enough. You have to keep trying to find that energy to move forward. So, in any event, so Sarah dies. But Tama Sarah, why does she die? So here Rashi quotes a Chazal that she was shocked that the Sutton tried to cause problems, and he did. That when Avram came back from the Akedah, he was on his way back, so the Sutton worked it out that she would get the message that Yitzchak was shechted, almost. And in that space between shechted and almost, she had a heart attack and she died. So here, my father, Zichron Levracha, Yertz is coming up in a few weeks, he used to get a major lesson from this, that he was always very, very makbid, that if he came back from a funeral or a shiva, and somebody was asking, whose funeral was it, whose shiva was it, so he would never say so-and-so, he wouldn't say Joe's mother. He would say the mother of Joe, the father of Joe. Because in that millisecond, when you say Joe's mother, so a person hears Joe, and then they think that this younger person passed away, and they have a big chalisha sadas before they hear the next word that is actually the parent. So he was very careful not to let people get that misimpression for a second. They would always cite this medrash that Sarah died because of the space between shechted and almost. But what exactly the whole message of the Sutton doing that is a good question. And there are some who explain that the path of the Sutton is he first tries to convince you to not do what you're supposed to do, or not to live up to your obligations, and then if he's not successful in that, and you end up succeeding in doing what you're supposed to do, so at least he gives you a charata afterwards. At least he'll make you feel bad about it, make you regret it. So here, Avram was Matzliach, and then the Soyun of the Akedah, so the Satan said, okay, but at least if Sarah dies because of it, so then he'll be Mescharit, and that will make him regret having done this. So in that vein, some explain also that the last word of this pasuk, v'livkosa, that he is crying over Sarah, which we'll talk more about in a second, so there's a small chaf. It's a question why there is a small chaf. And among the suggestions, they quote from some midrashim that it wasn't only Sarah who died, but that Avram had a daughter also, that Chazal, the Gemara, and Baba Basra tells us from the pasuk, says Avram was blessed bakol, so he also had a daughter. So maybe what this pasuk is conveying is that the daughter died the same day. So if you take out the chaf, it's l'spod, l'sara, ulvita. So Rav Moshe Feinstein has a truth about this in Chelik Dalin of the Igros Moshe, or Chaim Chelek Dal, it's one of the later Chalakim. So he has a tshuva there, which is many small pieces. So one of the small pieces is about this. He says, they say that there's a medrash that says like this, says it can't be. That doesn't make sense, that that would be such a disaster and such an onesh, and for there to be no explicit reference to it, then why would it make sense? Why would a Kadosh Baruch Hu do that? That he comes back from the Akedah and his son is saved, but he loses his daughter. It doesn't seem to be feasible. And the drasha that says there's a daughter is later. So like, it's in Shani that says that he was blessed with everything. So you could say, later on we're told he was blessed with a daughter and that daughter dies here. And Mesha says, doesn't make sense. It can't be. But what's the idea behind it? Some suggest it's an extension of this concept that Sutton is trying to really make Avram regret the whole thing. So it's a net loss if he ends up losing his wife and his daughter. So maybe that was the idea. But again, many of them are not the only one to think that this is not really a likely interpretation. But that's one of the ideas that's suggested. But in any event, so this idea of Vayavo Avram Lispo Lusarav Lufkosa. So This is a chiyuv. This tells us that this is the proper process, that we have an obligation of hesped, that we have a mitzvah of kvura, of burying the dead, and that's itself a chesed. But part of that chesed, that Rabbi Nabachi explains, this is a part of the chesed of kvura, is that there should be a hesped. That a hesped is there to help in the part of help as part of the process of kvura as a chesed to the mace. So Soloveitchik understood a little differently that it's a function of mourning, it's a function of avelus. But in any event, we find that hesped is something that's very important. And hesped, it's also interesting, I'll quote my father one more time, I mentioned this at his Levaya actually, that it would always point out that we translate hesped in English as eulogy. We would say it's a bad translation. It does not really connote what it's supposed to connote, and there are halachic ramifications. Because the word eulogy is from the Greek, and it means nice speech. Logos are words, and eu is nice, like euthanasia, paradoxically, and other such less common usages. So eulogy means to say nice words. That's what hesped often is. But the Hebrew word hesped is meant to invoke a mispaid, is meant to invoke crying and tears. So it has a very different connotation. And you would suggest that that also has implications for the many days that Eid Maspidim, the many days that are throughout the calendar, when we're not supposed to have hespedim. This is always a question. Does that mean should you not say anything, or should there be a different tone to the speeches at a levaya? So you would suggest that there's a difference between a hesped and a eulogy. A hesped is designed halachically, al pidin, to evoke tears, to make people cry. That's what it's supposed to do. It's supposed to bring about sadness and a sense of loss. And that is inappropriate on certain days that are inconsistent with that mood. But to say nice things about the person, eulogy in the literal translation, to say nice things about the person, so why shouldn't that happen just because it's Hanukkah, Rosh Chodesh, or the like? So that's halachically, there are many different approaches to that point, but he would draw that distinction, that there is a fundamental aspect of hesped which does not necessarily carry over to the literal translation of the word eulogy. The Gemara, Maseches Sanhedrin, has a machlokes. What exactly is the function of hesped? Do we say that hesped is yikara d'shachvi, that it's there for the purpose of the deceased? Or do we say that it's there for those who remain, it's there for the survivors, yikara d'chaye? So that's a machlokes. I first have to figure out what those mean, what those terms mean. So, you know, what would it mean to say, for example, that it's for the yikara d'shachvi? So on the one hand, there is a literal idea that it's part of the kavod that you do for the mace. We know that when it comes to a parent, so the Gemara says that there's an obligation of kibud av v'em both during the parent's lifetime and when the parents are no longer alive. And Rabbi Akiva Eiger and a few other achronim explain that even though kibud av v'em continues to apply when the parent is no longer alive, it's not the same kind of kibud av v'em that Kibud Av Eim when a parent is alive involves doing what they would like to see done, involves making them happy, and things like that, doing things that they appreciate and that they need, while when they're no longer alive, it's more about giving honor to them. It's more about increasing their name, saying Kaddish, and naming yeshivas after them, things like that. Those are all aspects of the Kavod HaMeis that the Kibud Av Ve'Eim that applies to a meis is different from the Kavod during a lifetime. So if that's the case, so then it's significant that this Hesped can serve that role also, can serve that role of Kibud in that sense. But also there is the notion that when the person is still alive, some suggest that there is Kavod in that sense also, because they anticipate, they see how other people get nice hesbedim when they pass away, and they anticipate what their hesped will be like, and that gives them some degree of nachas ruach. And there are others who suggest that it's more spiritual, that it means that up in Shemayim they're feeling the Kavod. This is how Rabbi Michal Tkachinsky, the author of the Gesher Achayim, understood that people who feel nachas ruach in the next world because they hear the hesped also, the idea that the mace is still around during the first 7 days, and so they are a part of the process, and therefore that's something that they get nachas. This week, we had the Karen B'Yavin dinner this week, and my Rebbe Rav Lachman was honored, and he started off his speech by saying how much he appreciated being able to hear his hesped while he was still alive. So, you know, that's an easier way to do it. But the idea also that the hesped is Yikara D'Chai, so to mention Karen B'Yavin again, when the Rosh Yeshiva of Golvach passed away, so we published a Sefer Zikaron for him, so we called it Yikara D'Chaim, based on this phrase in the Gemara, that possibly a hesped is supposed to be for the sake of those who remain. So his name was Chaim, so we called the Sefer Yikara D'Chaim, but there also you have to figure out, what does that mean? What does it mean to say that a hesped is for the sake of the living? So here also you have a few other interpretations. It gives the family nachas to hear what was said about the one who passed away. It gives them inspiration. It gives them chizuk. But also, it's for their basic honor in the sense that it's disgraceful the other way, that if a person should pass away, a decent person, as the Gemara calls it, an adam kosher, it's an obligation to be maspid an adam kosher, a decent person passes away, and nobody notices it, nobody remarks, nobody pays proper attention. So what does that say about the rest of us? What does that say about the survivors? It's a bizayon to the people who are left if they don't respond appropriately, so therefore it's a lack of their yakar in that sense if they are not able to give proper acknowledgement. So that's also definitely a part of the theme. So all of this contributes to the question of what the hesped is meant to accomplish. So as the Shulchan Aruch says, like we mentioned before, a hesped is supposed to bring about crying, is supposed to bring about a emotional response. And the Gemara Maseches Brachos says that Agra de hesped d'aliyei, that the measure of a hesped is calibrated, is evaluated based on the wailing that it evokes, based on the degree to which it gets people to respond. So again, in that sense, it's something that's incompatible with certain more joyous days of the year, and that's an additional component to saying things that are praising of the mace. In terms of that praising, so we know that in general we have an obligation of midvar sheker tirchok, that we have to try to be honest, but there is something to consider as far as how that affects this. So we don't say things that are obviously false, and we don't say things that are way disproportionate. Sometimes it's a struggle to find anything good to say. There's a famous story somebody reminded me of recently of the town miser and otherwise unappreciated individual who passed away, and they couldn't find anybody who had anything nice to say about him at the funeral. And finally, one guy says, "I can say something." He gets up and starts speaking, and he says, "His brother was worse." That's the only thing they could think of to say. So normally, usually there are better things to say, but in general, so it's an interesting question, how accurate do you have to be? So you're supposed to tell the truth, you're supposed to be honest, you shouldn't say things that are completely out of nowhere. But the Shulchan Aruch actually does say that it's permissible to say a little bit more than you know to be true, essentially to ratchet it up a little bit. So why is that appropriate? If we're supposed to be honest, so why is it appropriate to ratchet it up a little bit? So the different explanations, the Bach writes that we're concerned that we probably don't know exactly everything, and we are afraid that if we err on the other side, so then we may shortchange the person. And if we shortchange the person, so that's what the Gemara indicates, that's a very big offense, to not be maspid somebody karoi, to give them less credit than they deserve. So that's a bigger problem. So we don't want to run that risk. We don't want to run the risk of saying something that's less than should be said. The Aruch HaShulchan, commenting on this Bach, it says that this is also reflective of the fact that people understand that there is always a style of being a little bit heavier on the praise that a hesped than there would be in other contexts, and therefore it's appropriate to fit that style. Otherwise, by definition, you will be shortchanging the person because, first of all, you're going to be likely missing things if you only stick to what you know exactly, and especially since people expect the hesped to be glowing and people expect the hesped to be as positive as you can make it, the risk of falling short is going to be even greater in that context. The Sefer called Divrei Sofrim on Avelus by Rav Nachum Yavrov, and he adds to this that, you know, we saw last week that the idea that we're able to be Mishane B'nei HaShalom, that we find that there are times when sheker is not an absolute isser. So here, it's unlikely that you're really risking an actual midvar sheker tichak, which the Sefer Yireyim understands in the Ben Adam L'Chavero sense, that sheker is really prohibited in the absolute sense when you're hurting people. So here, it's not that the risk of error in that direction is not as high, so that's what the Bach is getting at, that you're better to err on the other side, to say a little bit more than you know, rather than risk saying less than should be said. And the Taz adds that it's very likely that if you're dealing with a righteous person and you say more than you know, that you're probably more likely to get a more accurate picture, because as the Chidah comments, as the Taz is getting at, that by nature, tzaddikim are hidden, tzaddikim are not showing you everything that they do. So if you say what you know, so then you can assume that there's more than what you know. So you can assume that you should move everything up at least one notch, that presumably if you know a certain degree of tzidkus from this person, so then you could assume that there's even more tzidkus that you don't know about. The Sefer Shevet Shimon on Yerideya, so he adds also, if we say that we're allowed to do this with Nei HaShalom, so there's also the fact, if you're concerned with the living, so the family is going to be upset if you don't give proper esteem to the individual, and you run the risk of causing machlokas and causing bad feeling in that sense. So if we're allowed to be Mishan Pnei HaShalom, that's also considered to be Pnei HaShalom. So all those factors together make it indicated that one should err on the side of saying a little bit more rather than saying a little bit less. But as the Taz points out, though, your focus always has to be Kavod HaMeis and not on showing off your wonderful oratorical abilities. And Sternbach also adds that if you're going to go on for too long, so then it becomes a delaying of the kfura, and that's not good. So there's a very delicate balance here, because really kfura should happen as soon as possible, but the hesped is a part of the kavod hameis, so we have the hespedim first, but then you have to really be plugged in to when the hespedim are contributing to the kavod hameis and when they're not really adding anything more, and then they are detracting from the kavod in the sense that it is delaying the kvura. Rishol David Harfenis has written many, many svarim. He's known for his svarim on Hilchos Shabbos and for many, many other things. So he has in his other writings that the obligation of Hesped is not only to give a speech at the funeral, that the obligation of Hesped has many different components to it, so participating in the Hesped by listening to it and by being present for it is also a part of this Kiyum. And also you can have a private Hespedim, so a person comes to a Shiva and he speaks to the family about what he knows about this person. So in general, it's already Nichum Aveilim, but that's also a part of Hesped, and he can speak to the other people and tell them, oh, you didn't know this person, but I knew him, and let me tell you. So that's also a part of Hesped, even if it's not delivered at the Kvura in front of the larger crowd. So there's a lot more to say about this, but unfortunately, just like the Hesped, sometimes you have to cut them short and then don't have as much time as you'd like. Just want to add one other important point about this Aliyah, so the rest of it talks about the purchase of Maris HaMachpelah, and we know, ironically, that we find that wherever our ancestors went out of their way to try to make it clear that they are acquiring legal title to the land, ends up being the areas that are most disputed. Hakar Satov to the American government this week for declaring that Jews living in the West Bank is not a legal occupation. But in any event, so this process of acquiring the land here, one of the points that emerges from this halachically is the whole process of Kiddushin. Say, Yalif Kicha Kicha Misdei Ephron. So when it comes to Kiddushin, so the Torah says, Ki Yikach Ish Isha, that Kiddushin should be an act of Kicha. And we figure out how you make the act of kicha, how you do kinyanim, from how land is acquired because of the gezeir shava to here to parshas chayisar. So I think it's important to emphasize. I don't know how many of you were here when we learned kedushin. I guess it was a while ago, but there's a misconception people often have that what you see from there, kinyan kedushin, yolof kicha kicha mistei afron, is that a Jewish wedding means that the man acquires the woman, the man buys the woman, essentially, and that's how we understand it. And don't think that's a correct understanding, that essentially what happens in the process of kedushin is that there is a declaration of commitment. The Rambam describes in Hilchos Ishus that before Matan Torah, people would just decide to live together, and that would be it, and that's how they would have their physical relationship. And the Torah declared that that's not right, that if you want to physically be with a woman, so then you have to commit to her first. You have to go through this process that creates obligations, that creates commitments, and the like, and that makes it a dignified and serious relationship with responsibilities. So therefore, there has to be a declaration of seriousness in order to make that happen. So where do you find in halacha that there's a declaration of seriousness? So you find that with kinyanim, that if somebody wants to transfer property to someone else, so then in order for that to happen, there has to be some overt symbol of their kemiras das, of their seriousness in taking this on. So we have a whole host of kinyanim. We have many, many different kinyanim that exist in order to display that seriousness. So if we want to figure out how do you make a commitment to a marriage, how do you display seriousness, so then you have to look to the process of kinyanim, and then we can figure out what it means to declare seriousness. So there are many rayas that it does not mean that you are purchasing the woman. There's a famous machlokas, the Taz and the Sma, about how to understand kinyan kesef, where the Sma explains that kinyan kesef could not be understood as a down payment, because we use that for kesef kedushin, and clearly it's not there a payment that's supposed to represent the value of anything else. It doesn't make sense in that context. Other Ashba and other Rishonim explain that we don't have a kinyan hagbah when it comes to kedushin, to carry her over the threshold, since that wouldn't make sense because she's not the davar haniknes. You're not purchasing the woman. It's only kinyanim that makes sense as far as an expression of seriousness, since we only have some of the many kinyanim that exist by property. Only a few of them are valid methods for kedushin, because it's really serving a different function, but it has this in common. It's all about displaying seriousness, and that's the nature of this limud from stay Ephraim. So there's a lot more to say about this, but unfortunately time is limited. So we'll stop here. I wish everyone a wonderful Shabbos, and we'll see you, God willing, on Sunday.